This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Rian Johnson rejuvenates the whodunit with Knives Out, Marielle Heller breaks our miserable hearts with A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Taika Waititi takes the piss out of fascism with Jojo Rabbit, and Mike Flanagan does his best Kubrick impression in Doctor Sleep. And we're going to get things started with Doctor Sleep, a film I was able to see Rian wasn't able to get to, and I even made a joke beforehand that I was going to say I resented Rian for making me sit through these 2.5 hour Stephen King adaptations that are very divisive, where I desperately need a second opinion. But I have to say, I did quite enjoy Doctor Sleep. It's, as a lot of people have pointed out, it's sort of a character-focused sequel and riff on The Shining, obviously adapted from the Stephen King novel Doctor Sleep, which essentially centers on the adult Danny Torrance, in this case played by Ewan McGregor, who partners up with Abra, this young girl played by Kylie Curran. And essentially both of them have essentially what is known as The Shining in some form or another. But the film is truly stolen by Rebecca Ferguson, who plays essentially our lead villain, Rose the Hat, who essentially along with her True Knot cult seek out those with special abilities and the shine and feed off them in order to live longer lives. I mean, it's a really interesting ensemble that we've got there. We've got I always forget his name, but he's sort of the giant in the David Lynch stuff, like from he was in Twin Peaks and stuff. He was in there as well as the great Zahn McLarnon. It was great to see him as Crow Daddy, who some people may know from season 2 of Fargo. It's great to see him getting work as a member of the cult. But, you know, the film essentially, you know, like I said, it essentially centers around Danny Torrance and this young girl, Abra. It sort of takes a while for them to meet up. It's really cool how they do their interactions with their special abilities. You see some of that in the trailers, but it's really interesting to see sort of, they make it feel like a big moment when they finally sort of meet up and use their abilities to try and track down these sort of villainous forces that are sort of hunting down random kids, including a little league playing Jacob Tremblay. So if you ever want to see Jacob Tremblay torn to bits, this is the movie for you. But I don't know, I really enjoyed it up to a point. You know, the first part of the film is this world-sprawling adventure, sort of moving from a drunken Danny Torrance haunted by previous events to Abra, who is discovering her powers for the first time as she's growing up, to Ferguson and her ensemble going around the country murdering children, for lack of a better word. You know, and as most people have pointed out, the film is at its best when it's doing its own thing. And some of the Shining connections definitely take you out. It's really interesting because the film starts with this sort of extended, sort of one of these classic sort of horror movie type things where it starts with Rebecca Ferguson sort of interacting with this young child. And it's sort of like, it's a really harrowing way to kick off the film. And then it cuts back to like a young Danny Torrance, but with an actress essentially filling the Shelley Duvall role. So some of the stuff is really interesting. I didn't mind that stuff because it was very removed from The Shining. It wasn't like they were trying to retread already familiar ground. It was something different, sort of post you know, Overlook Hotel, I guess you could say. You know, Mike Flanagan is a good horror director. He clearly has his heart, you know, in the right place, but I think he's a filmmaker, and I've seen some of his stuff that is good, but I don't think he's ever made something that's truly great yet. I feel like this is as close as he's come, but that's still with some caveats, for sure. But he's no Kubrick, but I could say that about really anyone. It's freaking Stanley Kubrick, so I'm not gonna hold that, you know, too much against him. And essentially, like I said, it's sort of, you know, this interesting generational gap where we start with adult Danny Torrance, who's, you know, he's sort of a drunk, he's going through a difficult time in his life, and he decides to get on the bus and move up to, you know, somewhere north of the Northeast. I forget which state. I know there was some New Hampshire and Maine in there, as always with the Stephen King stuff, so I forget exactly the town. It's been a few weeks since I've seen it, but I really enjoyed, you know, they really spent a lot of time with the adult Danny Torrance, really letting you get to know him early on, as there's a really good emotional build from him entering this new town, attending AA meetings, getting clean to his job as an orderly at a hospice care facility, and he essentially serves as, the title says, Dr. Sleep for the dying patients. It's really interesting. It's a really interesting thing that I wasn't expecting the way they did it, because I always heard about, you know, the weird direction that the sequel novel takes, but that that wasn't really too much of the focus of the film, so it's surprising that that's kind of the title of the film, but it's really interesting, and there's this sort of nice, interesting thing with the cat, that the cat knows when some of the patients are going to pass on. But I don't know, it's sort of like a very caring and gentle way to really get you invested in this adult Danny Torrance character, going from him in his drunken stupor to him sort of beginning to live his life sort of the way he wants to. But yeah, sort of after that, like I said, essentially he meets Abra, this young girl, and they sort of team up to sort of track down Rose and her gang of weirdos who all have sort of weird powers and stuff like that. These really wild sequences where she can sort of vision or travel. Like, essentially, she's suspended in air and sort of traveling all across the world. It's really wild stuff, but I sort of totally bought into it just because of the way Rebecca Ferguson really plays the role. But essentially, the film really builds to this climax at the Overlook Hotel, which was made famous, of course, in the original Shining. And I enjoyed it at first. Like, it was really fun. Like, it really made it feel like an event that you probably saw from the trailer. They have that classic cinematography over the sort of lake or river, whatever it is, from the original Shining. That's sort of the build, and you can hear that the score raises up, and it gives you chills. It's hard not to give yourself over to it, because most of the film is not that. Most of the film is centered on these characters and sort of building up to this climax, which of course takes place at this most famous location. And it starts, and it's really interesting, where Danny decides, he leaves little girl Abra outside, and he decides to go in, you know, for the first time. And it's sort of like, there's definitely, throwbacks to the original Shining. There's this scene that people's mileage may vary. I really loved it, where it's sort of, it's essentially sort of a different version, a new version of the classic bar scene with between Jack Torrance and Lloyd, this time with Danny Torrance and a version of Lloyd. I won't say anything more. Those of you that seen it know exactly what I'm talking about, the character that sort of fills the Lloyd role. Certainly a very iconic character, to say the least, played by a different actor, of course. But I really enjoyed that scene, the way it played. Like, it was just sort of like, oh man, Mike Flanagan, he knows what he's doing. He's got it. He's got the right exact way. And then after that, it gets a bit less successful. It's sort of really wild and crazy climax, a confrontation between Danny and Rose. And easily my least favorite part of the film is during this climax, there's these weird and completely unnecessary, is the major thing, cutaways that are essentially remakes of iconic scenes from The Shining, which is like, I don't know why they felt the need to do that. And essentially it amounts to literally less than a minute or two of screen time. So it's not like it's a major part, but it's just at the climax, they're like, oh look, it's a worse version of these iconic scenes you know and love. So that was a really odd choice. Like, I felt like if they took those out, like, it would have worked much better. I mean, the climax is still problematic. I wouldn't say it's completely successful at what it's trying to do, and it doesn't completely make complete sense, but they do bring it home after that, as it sort of, I think the film ends on a really powerful sort of character-based emotional note that sort of leads you to imagine sort of a future for some of these characters in particular. But overall, I will say I enjoyed it. And I think it would have veered into great territory if it avoided some of those specific riffs on The Shining. But I definitely recommend it. Obviously, it didn't do gangbusters at the box office, and Stephen King, of course, is trying to urge people to go see it. And I definitely recommend it, for sure. Like I said, your mileage may vary at some of The Shining riffs, but I think it's enjoyable, for sure. It's certainly a long sit, for sure. But I think you probably know if this is your kind of thing, you know, before going into it. So if it is your thing, I definitely recommend checking it out.
Is it my thing, Andrew?
It's hard to say. Like, it's like, I honestly don't know, but I want you to watch it. So I'm going to say, yes, it is your thing, Ryan. Watch it. I want to see your reaction to some of this stuff. Like I said, I enjoyed it. And thankfully, those Shining riffs are kept to a bare minimum. Like I said, it literally amounts to probably less than a minute of screen time, but it just felt completely unnecessary. Like people don't know these scenes, like the back of their hand. Like, I was just baffled by that. But yes, watch it.
Well, we're balls deep in the Christmas season at this point, so I might have to wait till next Halloween. But yes, I promise I will get to it eventually. 2.5 hours is a long sit. But let's just move right on to our next film, which we both, actually in the next three movies, yes, we managed to see all three of them, both of us. But we're going to go next into Mariel Heller's follow-up to Can You Ever Forgive Me, a film that Andrew and I were both head over heels for. That kind of falls in that same tonal balance, I think. And of course, this is A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers, which is just about the most on-the-nose casting that anyone could have ever fathomed for a role like this. It centers around Matthew Rhys, who plays this journalist for Esquire. I think it's a fictionalized version of a real journalist in this film. He's named Lloyd Vogel. I forgot what the real author's name was. It's neither here nor there. It basically, talking about the framing device that opens up the film is kind of the best way to go about it, because it just, you know, with material like this, it's easy to think of, you know, it's just eye-rolling Oscar bait crap. But I think what Heller does here so well, and what she did so well in Can You Ever Forgive Me, is mind those, like, quiet little moments of character and just letting the actors explore the emotion within it and guiding them in the right direction. And I think she has this burnished glow to everything. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The framing device that opens the film is basically a fictionalized episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where he's talking about the experience, where Fred Rogers is talking about the experience he had with this writer. And there's like this surreal fourth wall breaking that kind of pops up here and there throughout the course of the film that you don't really expect. It's almost touches in like like a Spike Jonze or Michel Gondry type way. And in the hands of a lesser filmmaker with a less clear vision who might not have been you know, brave enough to take those chances, and these chances don't necessarily scream I'm taking a chance, it just feels like a natural extension. But in the hands of anyone other than Mariel Heller, this movie probably would have been that, you know, middle of the road bullshit that we normally get in the mid-90s. You know, just, it's a Thanksgiving movie, you feel warm and fuzzy going in, but it doesn't feel manipulative, you know, to the extent, I mean, there is some obvious manipulation going on in the screenplay, but I think that Heller really digs at that humanity in the way that she does so well, and she really just, like, kind of gets to the idea of what made Mr. Rogers, you know, this imperfect vessel as he was, almost like messiah figure. And it's less an exploration of it's less a biopic so much as it is kind of like an exploration of the impact that he has on other people. And obviously Tom Hanks is very good. It's not a showy performance. He knows how to rein it in, and he knows not to go off the rails with this, and he knows when he's hitting those giant emotional beats. He plays it in such an understated way that I think really lets it sink in. And Mariel Heller just does such a great job with all like the white space in between lines of dialogue. There's like even one scene in a diner where he's eating lunch with this journalist, where he says, "Let's just take a minute to think about all the people who loved us into existence." And yes, the setup of that sounds horribly cheesy, but they actually take a full minute of silence, and you can just see the emotion pouring over Matthew Rhys's face, and it's just incredible to watch that play out. And, you know, obviously there's that story about you know, the emotionally shelled off writer with the new kid who just came into the world, and his wife, and he said he's a workaholic, and he has a really tedious relationship with his father who abandoned him when he was young. And oh my god, I didn't even realize Chris Cooper was in this until I walked in the theater. That was a pure joy to see. I'm a big fan of this guy, and I think that he plays these roles so well. I know he's done it before, but he just has like this intrinsic like ne'er-do-well guy who's just like really almost like that close to breaking on the surface, but you can see those cracks coming through, but he just does it so well, and his face is so weathered that when it gets to the final emotional gut punch, you really feel it. And even though both characters have done shitty things up to that point, you really buy into it, and it just makes you feel good, and it warms your heart, and it makes you tear up. You got a lump in your throat throughout the whole thing, and none of it feels manipulative. And this is a movie about Mr. Rogers.
Definitely. And, you know, my first note I have here is, and I wept, because I was, like, very emotional throughout this film. You know, I connect to film on a personal level, as I think most people will. Like, you mentioned that scene in the diner. There's, like, a moment where Tom Hanks and Mr. Wright, he essentially looks through the cave, breaks the fourth wall, and that's obviously a clear setup based on him talking about, oh, you know, when I'm working on my show, I like to look through the screen like I'm looking at each individual child, and it just sort of wrecks you completely. You know, I was definitely a kid who watched Mr. Rogers, so it's really fun to see this in this way. Obviously, he's had, you know, a bit of a moment the past few years from the documentary made about him to this film in particular, and it's just great. I think you hit the nail on the head with Mariel Heller. She's just a fantastic filmmaker, a perfect 3 for 3 for my money. Obviously, Ryan mentioned Can You Ever Forgive Me? She also made this film A Diary of a Teenage Girl, something like that, if that's not the exact title, that was also really interesting. And I think she's just an interesting filmmaker with a really unique perspective. And like you said, I feel like this film could have been completely maudlin if it was in the hands of another filmmaker, but she completely makes every moment feel completely genuine throughout. And that's not just her, but also the performances. You mentioned Chris Cooper. I knew he was in it heading in, but I didn't know, like, I assumed he was playing like a TV executive or something like that. It was a very nice, pleasant surprise to the type of character he got to play. He's always a welcome presence, and I thought that heart of the film, his relationship between him and Lloyd, played by Matthew Rhys, is just, I thought it was really, I don't know, it just really hit home a lot of the major points. You know, in the film, you can almost view Lloyd as essentially, you know, one of the kids who watch Mr. Rogers, where he's essentially learning from Mr. Rogers throughout the film. There's lots of scenes that are also quite kind of funny, almost, where the audience is tempted to laugh, where they're like very emotional moments, and Mr. Rogers being genuine, but you almost feel like a bit, you know, slightly, like, maybe you might feel uncomfortable when he's like, there's that scene where they're at Mr. Rogers' house and he's like bringing out the puppets and stuff, and he's just sort of like, instead of answering, you know, Lloyd's questions, that he's trying to get to the bottom of, you know, Mr. Rogers' relationship with his kids and stuff, he's just bringing out the puppets. He's like, oh, you want to meet King Friday the 13th and stuff like that. And I thought that was just such great, and like you said, Tom Hanks' casting is on the nose, but it's also pitch perfect. Like, everyone knows that Tom Hanks is such a kind, genuine guy, and obviously that's exactly what Mr. Rogers is. A kind and genuine guy, not without his troubles. And I thought that was one of the great things about the film as well, where they touch on, you know, some of the things that Mr. Rogers, he's like, oh, I'm not a perfect person, I might seem like that, you know, from the outside, but I've had my struggles with my children and my relationships and stuff. And I thought that was a nice touch to sort of bring that to the front of the film, whereas a lot of people wouldn't necessarily expect that. But yeah, you mentioned the framing device. I love that the use of that, where he's essentially having an episode of his show centered around Lloyd, and I thought that was really fun. There's a really wild fantasy sequence later on in the film centered around Lloyd, and I also loved the use of miniatures, you know, the classic spirit of Mr. Rogers. That was a really great touch. I loved that when it's like not even just, you know, the Mr. Rogers set, like when Lloyd's traveling from city to city, they use that and through the airplane and stuff like that. I thought that was just really nice and a fantastic touch. And I think a lot of people are going to connect to this on such a personal and deep level. And I definitely did as well. There's also that scene on the subway, which is sort of given away in some of the trailers. But I have to say, like, when it happened on screen, I was like, oh, God, I can't contain myself. Like, and that's the thing. I knew this scene was coming, and I still couldn't because I didn't notice, you know, from the trailers, like, the kids, everyone's singing the song on the subway. And I thought that was such a genuine touch, where it's not just the kids who embrace Mr. Rogers. It's these adults who might have seen him growing up. And I thought that was such a powerful statement on. It's not just, you know, obviously, it might feel cheesy or campy if you were to watch it as an adult, but I think if you have that connection to him, you feel that connection to him, and I think this film does a great job of highlighting that for sure.
Definitely, and you can't stress it enough. It was just like the right people in the right place at the right time to make this movie, and they took the right approach. This is obviously something that, you know, I am a very shockingly cynical person, so to read about this kind of thing on paper, you just kind of roll your eyes, but they pull it off. There are really no two ways about it, and it just succeeds in the little moments, and there's one in particular that kind of stands out to me, where Matthew Rhys is kind of grilling Tom Hanks about, you know, with this emotional burden that Mr. Rogers has to carry, just because, you know, he's taking on so many other people's sadness, and he's like coaching them through some of the most horrid events that a child could ever experience, you know, whether, you know, death, divorce, even coping with the Vietnam War, that kind of thing. And that pays off in pretty much the last shot of the movie. You know, I mentioned that we had that framing device in the beginning where it's on that fake episode of Mr. Rogers. So when that fake episode of Mr. Rogers wraps up and then we see Mr. Rogers on the set watching himself in the monitor, he just goes over to the piano and all the lights start dimming and everyone's leaving the studio and he's playing the piano. And this is another thing that was kind of given away in the trailer about how you can kind of cope with feelings of sadness. You just, you know, you can slam all the lowest keys on the piano, boom, and you can tell that in this instance that Tom Hanks' Fred Rogers is really just like kind of mulling over this entire scenario in his head, and he's just sitting at the piano, and then he just goes bomb, bomb, and releases that kind of whatever tension he was feeling and whatever sadness and anger he was feeling because of this situation that he just coached this guy through. It's really just like those little small touches that add up, and you don't even realize, like, you just want, or even like fucking when Mr. Rogers is in the beginning and he's, you know, talking to this handicapped, this sick kid, I should say, terminally ill, and he's like playing with this toy sword, and he's like, oh, you must be pretty strong to pick that up, and the kid just drops a sword and hugs him, and it's just like those little moments, you don't even realize the film is breaking your heart, but then you feel something running down your cheek, and you're like, holy shit, what the hell just happened to me?
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up that scene, because I think about, you know, all the people working on the show, and they're like, oh, this is the millionth, it's a great time to give some exposition, where it's like, oh, he's always doing this type of thing, where he's just like, takes forever, he's like, we can't fire him, can we? You know, it's just sort of tongue-in-cheek. I love the little stuff like that, where it just sort of builds out the world, but just gives you a sense that, oh, he's like this all the time, and that's always the thing, where it's like, oh, no one can be this genuine and nice all the time, and like we alluded to, the film touches on, you know, Mr. Rogers' certain struggles at different times, but, you know, like you said, he is sort of just a genuine, nice spirit, and, you know, the film obviously embraces this kindness, you know, that we need, and I think it's definitely a film that's important for now, and what I like about the film, I think it's a very important film, but it never feels self-important, and I think that's the key, where Marielle Hilary does this great balancing act, where it never veers into that territory, where every single moment feels genuine. I think there's a great catharsis to the film. I love some of the scenes toward the end where the family is all together and Mr. Rogers is there. It was sort of unexpected, and I really liked that. Some genuine moments getting to see Tom Hanks and Chris Cooper on screen together. I thought that was some really nice touches. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's just one of those films that people can relate to, whether you've gone through struggles in any familiar relationships you've had, or whether you just have this connection to Mr. Rogers from your childhood. And I think that's sort of a great touch. I also want to give a shout out to the actress that plays Matthew Reese's character's wife, Kalichi. Oh God, I'm gonna blank on her name now. I wrote it down in the article as a tag, but I forgot to write it down in my notes. But she also brings a lot of spirit to it, and she sort of echoes that, which is like, oh, don't ruin my childhood, Lloyd. And I thought she sort of brought a lot. There's this great scene sort of towards the end where, you know, Matthew Reese's Lloyd, you know, he's sort of taking a step back, you know, and sort of like he's having a hard time dealing with his relationship with his father, and she just sort of, you know, tries to get him back, you know, to a place, you know, of where they can function together. And so I think all the actors are just work so well together in this film, and it definitely gets my highest recommendation for sure.
Absolutely. Be nice to everyone, and for love of God, go to therapy. Next up, we have Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit, which has proven to be one of the most divisive movies of the award season to this point, which I, you know, honestly, I'm kind of surprised by that. I think this is a pretty cleared, you know, the satire... man, all right, so it's really hard. I understand why people don't want to laugh at this and aren't ready to laugh at this kind of subject matter, but I also feel like Waititi's grip on this satire is so strong that it doesn't matter whether or not you're ready to laugh at it. I really didn't laugh at too much in this film, just because, obviously, you know, we're talking about Nazis here. The film itself centers around this little kid, Jojo Rabbit, Rabbit being the pejorative name that was assigned to him after he decided not to kill a bunny in Hitler's youth camp, so obviously you can already kind of tell where the movie's going to be headed, which is a good thing, because you got, and much like, you know, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, you feel good kind of coming out of this movie. But the little kid is played by Roman Griffin Davis, who is just, what a hell of a child performance. And, you know, you always hate to say, you know, pigeonhole kids. This is a great performance, period. The fact that he's only 10 years old is really just that much more impressive. But it's just, basically, he has Taika Waititi as Hitler, as his imaginary friend, and, you know, he's kind of picturing him just, you know, propping him up and making him feel better about himself, and as he's kind of going out and, you know, furthering the cause. And meanwhile, his mother, played by Scarlett Johansson, who is just, you know, you forget how good she is. She's just been stuck in the Marvel stuff for so long. You forget when she just kind of lets loose how good she actually can be in these movies. The mother, who's basically, you know, wondering why her son is just like such a fanatic about Nazism. And, you know, she's obviously anti-German government, essentially. And she's spreading propaganda across the city. And she also happens to be harboring a Jewish girl, 17-year-old Jewish girl, played played by Thomasin McKenzie, who we saw in Leave No Trace last year, who was very, very good in that film, and she's very, very good here. But it's just, this is ultimately a film about how, you know, the world is kind of crumbling. It's towards the end of World War II, and Jojo Rabbit's worldview is kind of crumbling around him because this is kind of what he always knew. He wants to be, you know, little kids are kind of lost in the struggle, and they want to just kind of feel like they belong, and a lot of that involves doing some really shitty things. And I think that it also kind of reads as a little bit more prescient, considering how many kids are being indoctrinated into far-right ideology through YouTube and, you know, morons like Alex Jones and Ben Shapiro. So to see this film, you know, touching upon that kind of thing as well, really just, it just gives it, like, this, you know, even when you're, like, kind of wanting to laugh at what's going on screen, there's, like, this undercurrent that makes you feel deeply uncomfortable. And I think that's when, you know, satire is at its best. It straddles that line. There are some jarring tonal shifts, and there are some some actors who kind of take some broad swipes at the material that doesn't necessarily land from a comedic standpoint, but I did giggle at times. And, you know, whether or not you are ready to laugh at it yourself, that's okay. You are allowed to have whatever reaction you want to the material being presented. I just happen to think that the satire and the sending up and the taking the piss out of Nazism and fascism and showing how it can become a fallacy and suck in youth, really just, it works. This movie lands for me.
Definitely, I completely agree, and I've mentioned to Ryan before, I was like, this is like one of the feel-good movies of the year, and it feels weird to say that because it's centered around Nazism, but it truly is, because as you see the arc of this young boy who, as Ryan has mentioned, you know, is blinded by his sort of fanaticism, with Taika Waititi standing in as essentially Hitler, and sort of his sort of, essentially imaginary friend, and that's sort of like a really interesting dynamic. I think Taika Waititi was the exact right person to play that role, obviously not only with him being the filmmaker behind this, but he knows exactly the tone he's going for and how high to play that role and how, when to sort of, you know, just sort of go for it, for lack of a better term, or have that character take a back seat and sort of fade into the background as Roman Griffin Davis's Jojo, the character played by Thomasin McKenzie, as they sort of bond and sort of their relationship develops over time. But, you know, I don't think it's a hot take to say that Taika Waititi is one of the best humans alive. I think he's such a joyful presence. You watch him in an interview, he just has such a unique personality. But I think he just has a way in all of his films of finding humor in completely unexpected places, and giving a film heart in the most unexpected ways. And I think this is the best example of that, because obviously, as he said, he has to sort of walk this tightrope of sort of, you know, of sort of taking on Nazism. But I think he does it perfectly. I can certainly understand where for some people, maybe some of the tonal shifts might not work for them, but I completely did, because I understood exactly what Taika Waititi was doing. You mentioned those early scenes. Weirdly enough, it actually kind of reminded me of, like, Wes Anderson, like, with a bit of Moonrise Kingdom or something. It sort of reminded me of that a bit, sort of early on, but then it becomes purely Taika Waititi. You mentioned Scarlett Johansson, who I think is incredible in this film. There's that amazing scene where essentially, you know, Jojo's father is sort of not, you know, a part of the story. Essentially, they sort of allude to the fact that he's sort of gone off, to war, although it's not exactly clear exactly what he's doing, for sure. I thought that was going to be like a setup or something, but it really wasn't. But there's this fantastic scene between Scarlett Johansson and her son where they're sort of at the dinner table. She's like, oh, why are we talking about politics at the dinner table? And then she sort of plays a dual role pretending to be his father and stuff. And I thought that was such a unique scene, but man, she pulls it off like in spades. And I think that's the important thing about the film. We have all these different characters with all these different perspectives. We have Sam Rockwell sort of playing sort of a Nazi, you know, official, but a complete just goof. And there's sort of Alfie Allen is playing his right-hand man. And I feel like the illusion was clearly that there was something going on here, perhaps a gay relationship or something, or it doesn't go further down that path. But I liked the simple touches of that, just pointing out the complete ridiculousness of it. Early on, they make that clear with the book burning scenes and stuff like that. There's this great scene where Stephen Merchant and his Nazi brothers show up at Joe Joe's house, and he completely takes the piss out of the Heil Hitler salute. And I think it's stuff like that where you clearly understand exactly what he's doing. Like, I love the scenes between JoJo and Thomas and Mackenzie's character where he's just in the early scenes where they're interacting, JoJo's just spouting the most ridiculous, absurd stuff about Jewish people you could imagine. And then as they get to know each other, he clearly sort of starts to fall for her. And it's really interesting the way that relationship develops and how JoJo is sort of taken out of his fanaticism through that. I also loved the scenes between, I already alluded to that scene, you know, around the dinner table and sort of Scarlett Johansson doing that high wire act. But I love the simple bonding scenes with her and her son. You know, there's the bike riding scene. It's just simple moments. I thought that was a really nice touch to sort of build out that mother-son relationship and show she truly cares for him and doesn't want him to live this particular, you know, fanatic life for sure. And I don't know, I just really, really enjoyed it. There's some great use of music for sure. There's that iconic opening credit sequence, which I couldn't believe, but I thought it was so perfect. You know, and all the German covers are great. There's that great cover of Heroes, it sort of brings the film to a close. I just thought the choices of music and doing it in the different language, I thought worked absolutely perfectly, and just sort of, you know, takes you away to this place where it's like, yes, Nazism is a terrible thing, and it happened, you know, but, you know, I think Taika Waititi is taking the correct approach where he's like, this stuff deserves to be made fun of because it is so absurd and so ridiculous. And, you know, I admire him for taking that on, you know, when obviously some people aren't going to be able to go with him for that. And I certainly understand if you come from a certain perspective or come from a certain culture where it might be difficult to do that. But for me, I just admire him for even taking this, you know, attempt. And I think he pulls it off masterfully. And it is one of my favorite films of the year for sure.
Well, that's the thing. The subject material shouldn't be controversial. Like, the idea of insulting Nazism really should not be a source of consternation for people. But, you know, lo and behold, here we are. I just think that Waititi does that such a balancing act. Like, he sets them up as fools in a way that, and like you said, it's not going to land for everyone. And like I said, I don't think everyone is going to be ready to laugh at this movie. But I do think that he, and, you know, was it you were telling me that, like, he was in an interview and he basically said, you people really need me to tell you that Hitler was bad. Like, it's pretty obvious what's going on in this film, and he does such a fine tightrope act with this, especially in the third act when things really go haywire and it's the end of the film and the Allied forces are kind of bearing down on this city or town. It's never really kind of revealed where it is, but it's you know, and even like the little touches of humor sprinkled throughout that is just so shocking and jarring, but it's still it all lands. I don't understand how the hell this man pulled this off, but he really just, you know, he shows everything from the perspective of Jojo Rabbit, realizing that everything he grew up knowing is basically figuratively and literally crumbling around him. And just, you know, that doe-eyed innocence that Davis kind of brings to the role is unbelievable. But really, just hats off to Waititi for being able to pull off something just so absurd and something that would seem so broad, but that really had some of the, like, just emotional gut punches that I did not expect going in. Maybe I should have. This is a Holocaust movie after all.
Yeah, and I think Taika Waititi is just one of those masterful directors. He's able to get these incredible child performances, and this film definitely continues that trend across of the multiple roles. But I also loved the touch of having the kids essentially serving in the army. Like, it's sort of just a complete absurdist touch. And I thought those little moments, I thought they really hit home, just sort of him highlighting the complete absurdity of this and sort of pointing out that you could even make the connection that, you know, having these thoughts is completely childish and is completely absurd and ridiculous. Obviously it is, but it's just sort of, I love the way through the lens that he chose. I think it's the perfect lens, because I think it would be really difficult to tell this type of story from, you know, an older character's perspective, but telling it from, you know, through, you know, as a doe-eyed sort of child innocence, you know, I think it works on that level. But yeah, I think both of us, you know, really, really enjoyed the film, and fuck off, Hitler. and so with that in mind, we'll turn our attention to our last film that we're going to be discussing today, which just recently came out, which is the latest from Rian Johnson. It's Knives Out, sort of a murder mystery whodunit. And I can honestly say this is probably the most I've enjoyed a film all year. I was literally throughout like the last like hour or so, I think I was shaking and giddy. I was like enjoying myself so much. Admittedly, that's not a shock coming from me, because this is like completely in my wheelhouse. You know, Ryan, for those of you who don't know, obviously Rian Johnson directed the very divisive Last Jedi, but he's also directed this film Brick, which I'm a massive fan of, which is definitely more of the independent film realm, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, which is sort of a high school tale, but completely noir and sort of turns things on its head. And what I love about this film is I got really pumped for it based on the ensemble and the trailers, but it completely upended my expectations even as I was watching it. And that's absolutely what I loved about it, because there's nothing the trailer could do to spoil this movie for you, honestly, just based on his very unique approach to it. You know, this is the type of film that isn't made, you know, nowadays. And that's what I admire about it so well. But I don't know, I just loved simply every single second of it. But essentially, you know, Daniel Craig, oh my God, he is absolutely brilliant, and the fun he's having is infectious. Essentially, he plays this character, Benoit Blanc. He's a classic-style investigator who is willing to do anything to essentially solve the demise of Harlan Thrombey, played by the icon Christopher Plummer, who in this film is sort of playing this character who's a famed murder mystery writer who certainly has a family of great wealth. And Benoit Blanc teams up with Marta Ana de Armas in a big-time breakout role for her, for sure, who essentially is Harlan's nurse. And teams up as well with some of the local cops, played by Lakeith Stanfield and Rian Johnson regular Noah Segan, who's sort of a fanboy of Harlan's work. I love the simple touches they have for some of these characters. And essentially, they all work together in order to get to the truth of who truly killed Harlan, although that's not the only sort of major mystery going on in this sort of classic, as Rian Johnson has talked about, Agatha Christie style whodunit. But I think even saying that is sort of like selling it a bit short, because it is this twisty and turny film. But like I said, Rian Johnson is just such a unique filmmaker that he does it in a way that is just completely unique and unexpected. You know, early on, you know, what makes the film so brilliant is, I think, the way the story is told. You know, you expect going in that it is this classic whodunit, and then early on there's this sequence where it seems to almost solve you know, the murder, although obviously there's more to it than that, to say the least. But there's this great scene between Ana de Armas and Christopher Plummer, who this is the most like fun I've seen him have in that one scene alone, where he's really hamming it up and he has some really unique lines. And I don't know, it's just great to see Christopher Plummer having a lot of fun. Obviously, we've seen him be great. You know, he was great in that film Beginners by Mike Mills. And, you know, he is just, you know, an icon. It's great to see him still doing great, interesting work, even though obviously he's the victim of this, so he's not like one of the major players in the film. But, you know, Rian Johnson takes that scene, sort of turns it on his head, completely changes what you expect, but then there's all these really subtle setups that completely pay off, you know, at the climax in the film, which, oh my God, Daniel Craig gives an absolute tour de force in that climactic scene where everything is sort of revealed. It's the classic, you can probably envision it if you know what type of film this is, where you're sort of just going through sort of the, oh, and then this happened, and then he's sort of peeling back the layers, and it's just completely brilliant. I think him, you know, Ana de Armas in particular, I think Chris Evans is also really fun and great as sort of the black sheep of the family. But the whole ensemble, like, I love the opening sequence where essentially we're cutting. Essentially, they're interviewing all the different family members, and they're sort of cutting around. They're sort of, some of them are telling half-truths, and we cut around to one person starting to tell the story, and then we cut to another character sort of finishing the story in their own way. It's that classic way where you're sort of getting, and there's all sorts of different mysteries and relationship dynamics in play. But like I said, I think this is the most fun I've had at the movies all year. I think this script, I mean, I can't even fathom, like, I think Rian, I forget what it was, because I listened to him in an interview, and he said he wrote this script in, like, it was, like, such a short amount of time, I was like, what? Like, I couldn't even imagine how you're able to pull something like this off, but he wrote it in just, like, a very short amount of time at the beginning of this year, and the turnaround was literally that quick, and then Daniel Craig immediately signed on, apparently, and then everyone else sort of fell into place after that. It's a great ensemble. You've got Jamie Lee Curtis, Don Johnson, Michael Shannon, Shannon, Toni Collette. I could go on and on, all of them with their unique perspectives. And I think what's great about it is sort of the perfect Thanksgiving movie because it has all these characters with all their different political leanings, all their different ridiculous opinions. And they sort of like the way they clash, like the Will reading scene is an instant classic. Like I could try and name a favorite scene, but it's almost impossible for me to do so because there's all the, every few minutes, there's like a scene that pops up. I'm like just laughing my ass off and just having a great time at the movies. And I think if you want to, you could definitely do a whole lot worse than Knives Out.
Oh, for sure. This is so I liked it quite a bit. I wasn't as over the moon as you were about it, although I kind of expected that. I knew that this was going to be up there for you. I just found myself greatly enjoying this. I was a huge, huge fan of the movie Clue, which is actually mentioned by name in this film, although I think they're referring to the board game and not necessarily the movie. But, you know, you mentioned that Daniel Craig scene where, you know, the big reveal is happening and he's kind of like just basically going over all the evidence and peeling back the layers. It reminds me of Tim Curry just going nuts at the end of Clue in any of the three endings that you picked. But that's what's just greatly enjoyed. It's a throwback, and the cast is just having an absolute blast. You know, Michael Shannon, this is a guy, it might not seem like a showy role, but he's just, like, doing so many, like, weird little subtle things that only he'd be able to pull off that is just unbelievably fun to watch. Christopher Plummer, I've never seen him this giddy on screen, much like I'm sure you were in that chair actually watching it. But, yeah, it's hard for me to, like, really kind of expound upon it because it was something that was just purely enjoyable, and there is some subtext in there of kind of, you know, deconstructing the idea of, you know, despite people's supposed liberal political leanings, they will always side with their money. Whether that, you know, I don't want to give anything away beyond that because it is a little spoilery. But, you know, and that's a criticism that I've always had of rich people in real life. So I'm just kind of glad that someone is actually, you know, throwing that up on the screen. It's that soft liberalism, the idea that, you know, you're rich and it automatically makes you, you know, somehow superior to everyone else. And, you know, even when, you know, the people are treating the nurses, you know, she's not the help, she's basically family. And you kind of learn that really might not necessarily have been the case. And it's weird seeing that kind of thing play out in a major motion picture. I know we had, you know, this socialist epic in Tim Burton's Dumbo earlier this year, but it's good to see that. And the way it ends is you just feel like kind of pumping your fist in the air just because it's so vindicating watching what happens. You mentioned that great Will reading scene. Great to see Frank Oz in something again. Yes. Too. That was, I mean, holy shit, man. There are just so many like nice little touches. It's an enjoyable film. There really isn't too much to dig into in turn. And well, you know, Andrew and I are complete nerds, so we dig into like the little minutia. So there really wasn't much like in terms of lasting power for me, but that's, you know, that's not a knock against the film. Like you said, it's just purely enjoyable. I think it's definitely solid, and yeah, it's Thanksgiving family quarrels. What the hell else could you want?
Yeah, and I think people will relate to it sort of on a level. I think I related to it on a deeper level than maybe some people will, just because I certainly related to family sort of being thrown into chaos after the death of sort of a patriarch or matriarch, for sure. And I also saw an interview with the cast, a really fantastic one, where they sort of essentially had a Thanksgiving dinner. I think it was for Entertainment Weekly, where they're all talking about how insane the idea of a will is, where a lot of them were like, this is really insane, where it's sort of like, oh, you die and then everything has to be left to people. And sort of I thought it made some interesting points about stuff like that. I think it sort of maybe depends on your perspective, but yeah, I think it is purely a piece of entertainment, but I think there is a lot to chew on if you really go deep into it. And like I alluded to, I think there's a lot of really subtle things, like throwaway lines early on in the classic whodunit way, throwaway lines or throwaway moments where you don't even think anything of it, but then they completely come back, you know, in a big way sort of at the climax. I love, like I said, there's so many scenes I loved in this. There's also, I really love the unique character trait they give Marta. I thought that was a really interesting and unique touch, which I won't spoil for you here. But I also love, I think it's really fun the way, you know, she's working alongside Benoit Blanc, but when we learn some different information, she's also working against him at times. And I thought Ana de Armas does a great job of that. But yeah, you mentioned that last shot. I heard people allude to, oh man, what a killer last shot. not, you know, in some of the reviews, and man, they were not lying. That is like the most perfect, like in a visual way of just saying everything without having to say anything. And man, Rian Johnson, I think he's just such a unique filmmaker. But like I said, this type of film just isn't made nowadays. And that's why I think I just went gaga for it. Like, I wasn't only giddy like in the theater, but I was like giddy for hours, like afterwards. I was just like on cloud nine. And I think obviously, you know, we're both massive film nerds, you know, that's why we have a podcast about film. Gee, who knew? But it's like, you know, when a film does this, you know, there's been so many films I've loved this year. And honestly, I think it's shaping up to be a really fantastic year based on a lot of the stuff I've seen, for sure. But I just haven't had this much fun at the theater in general. And I think what's great about this film is this isn't just for film nerds. I think most audiences are going to be able to go for this and go gaga for it for sure. And I just think, you know, the ensemble front to back is just really great. Rian Johnson is just such a unique filmmaker with such a unique perspective, and that comes across in every moment, you know, of this film. And I figured I'd end this review by saying, because Last Jedi was so divisive, I'm gonna quote the great Ransom character in this film: "Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit," to the Rian Johnson haters.
Yeah, I really couldn't have said that any more succinctly myself. We're going to be talking more about why that kind of started. We did a whole episode about it already when the movie came out, but I want to chew more on why people are as awful as they are when it comes to Star Wars. But yep, Knives Out, it's really entertaining, and I can't say that any more succinctly than that. I mean, if you want to go see actors have a bunch of fun, that's in an infectious way. And if you want to see this a filmmaker who is really just like has such a clear vision and is in complete control of his craft and has such a beautiful vision of what the set of the house should look like, it's enjoyable. It's a throwback. I mentioned Clue. This is in that same pantheon. Just go, enjoy, have fun. But with that in mind, we're going to turn our attention to next week, when we are going to be digging into a couple streaming things. There was this past Wednesday, there was the release of a movie you might have heard of called The Irishman, directed by Martin Scorsese. It's 3.5 hours, so, you know, you'll probably catch it on within 10-minute spurts on the toilet when you're running away from your toddler over this holiday weekend. But, you know, in addition to that, I'm mentally preparing myself because I'm watching that after we record. But we're also going to be taking a look at a political thriller, The Report, which is about basically the uncovering of the CIA's torture program after 9/11. That's going to be pure joy, right?
Oh, definitely, and it is Adam Driver season, so we're getting, you know, our first glimpse of Adam Driver, then we'll be getting to him very briefly after with Marriage Story, and then, of course, The Rise of Skywalker. You know, it's just, you know, Adam Driver is such a unique actor. He can do all this different stuff, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to both The Irishman and The Report. Obviously, The Irishman is getting raves all over the place, and The Report's gotten a good reception as well, so it should be fun to dive into the streaming wars, as we will be over the course of the next few weeks in general. But without further ado, thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.